From Variety, celebrating 115 years covering the business of entertainment, this is the Award Circuit Podcast. Last summer, as the United States and the world finally turned more attention to systemic racism and police brutality, John Boyega made headlines by grabbing a megaphone and lending his voice to a movement.
I think first and foremost, I'm black. That means a lot to me when I say that. You know, I still have family, you know, I still have people, friends, and even distant acquaintance I have, you know, special love for, that are still vulnerable to these situations, regardless of where I come from. So first off, that's the thing, is that your own experience, you know, and the second thing really is just the sorrow that it gives you to see black bodies continuously treated that way. I have a closer relation to that kind of issue. Because that looks like my uncle down there, that looks like my father. And so the kind of uproar, even though it was global, you know, people from all different races and creeds came up and stood out.
I'm Michael Schneider, and on this edition of the Variety Awards Circuit Podcast, we talked to small act star John Boyega about working with Steve McQueen and telling the real life story of Leroy Logan, a trailblazing London police officer in the 1980s. Later on, we chat with comedian Z-Way on the eve of her new Showtime sketch and talk series. But first, on the Variety Awards Circuit Roundtable, we kick off Emmy season with a look at what's in store for the next several months. It's all next as we flip the switch and go TV on Variety's Awards Circuit Podcast. Stay close. Why, hello, everyone. Welcome back to Awards Circuit. This is a little different. It's TV time. We're taking over. Finally, the cool kids are in charge. Emmy season, the true season, the season everyone's been expecting for a long time. And it's finally officially happening. It never really ends. But anyway, I am Michael Schneider, you know, and here with me, Danielle Terciano. Hello, Danielle.
Hi, I'm excited to finally get on this podcast. It's been film season for what feels like forever. And so I'm excited. It's finally Emmy season.
Yeah, it was inevitable. Emmy season was going to be here. We were going to have to start talking. So I'm glad we're finally underway. And of course, joining us as well, she gets no rest. It never ends for Jazz Tanque. Jazz.
Hello.
Jazz, is it hard to sort of shift your brain, especially during this past month where it was sort of Oscar and Emmy season at the same time?
Do you know, I was doing that slow transition. I was like, I've seen all the films. I'd be happy to like not write about them. And every time I was like, this is my last piece on Oscars, I was like, hey, can you do one more story? We've got one more. And I'm like, I'm trying to transition over into TV. So they kept pulling me back, but... Yeah. It is hard when you're like, I've got to like watch 10 episodes of a show and, you know, you're still writing predictions and stuff.
Yeah. No. And, you know, I like to say that TV award season, of course, never really ends since we've got Globes, we got Guilds during the winter months, but film season, I mean, so Clayton Davis has already put up his Oscar predictions for 2022, like not even a week. You're not even going to take a week off. You're already predicting things that we haven't seen yet. We're not going to see for a long time. I love in his song predictions category, he doesn't even know what the songs are. He's just like predicted song from, you know, fill in the movie here. God bless him.
House of Gucci or whatever, right? Like right. That's what they do. That's what you do. Like the next day, it's like who gets their predictions out first? And it's a complete crapshoot. But he did pick Nomadland last year.
That's true. He did. He was pretty early on that train.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was a smart move. So now he's got to match that for next year. Well,
no pressure.
In the meantime, on the TV side, I mean, we've been going into this Emmy season sort of saying, well, is it already predetermined? Is it Ted Lasso, The Crown, and The Queen's Gambit? I mean, are we just riding that wave all the way to Emmys, Danielle? What do you think?
It's so funny because, you know, I think a couple of weeks ago, had we started this discussion, we would have said that. But now, you know, being in May, finally in May, there are all of these late entries, last minute, we're going to get in right before the voting closes, or rather the eligibility closes, and capture your attention. So, I mean, I don't think that. I mean, I think Ted Lasso is still something everyone's going to be talking about and is absolutely going to get nominated. You know, it's having its second season drop in July while people are voting on the first season is just that perfect timing. And we saw Succession benefit from that, you know, in the last round. But there's some new players. I mean, Hacks from HBO Max with Jean Smart, it's coming in really, really strong. So I think this could be a big year for her and for that show. And then, you know, you look at limited series category is just so stacked. Like Queen's Gambit is a huge player, but then you've got Small Axe, which is still in the running, and then you've got the Underground Railroad, which is just dropping. And those, I think you can't ignore those. And I think, you know, there's a number of other shows from a lot of players. Mayor of Easttown from HBO is getting a lot of traction right now. I'm reluctant to be like, yes, let me predict it right now. Like, I don't know how Clayton does it, because I'm like, not that I don't want to be wrong per se, but I don't want to overlook anything because it's still so early in the game.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Jazz, has there been anything recently that started to maybe change your mind or make you think this is going to be a tighter race in some of these categories than we thought?
I think I agree with Daniel. Like the limited series category just, I mean, I change every day with these shows. And Danielle, I don't know how you watch so much TV, like where you find the time.
But I don't have to watch the films that you watch. See, that's the difference. Like as Mike was talking to you earlier about you transitioning, I don't have that. I just do TV. And so if you look at it that way, it's like, well, you know, when I'll be honest, and I probably shouldn't admit this on an awards podcast, but I haven't seen any of the Oscar nominated movies because I haven't had time. Because it's not part of my job. But I've seen all of the Emmy shows, even the ones that haven't dropped yet. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, what's impressive about Danielle is that she also, on top of this, reads 100 books a year at minimum.
I try. Let's not put me on blast. I try.
No, this is a shout out to you. You're already up to 50, and it's still
That's
April.
That's true.
So it's May.
It's May. It's true. I hit 51 over the weekend. I was very excited about that. The 50th book was not very good, so I won't name it. But the 51st book, I really enjoyed. So, you know, here we are.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's, I don't know. Jazz, I feel like you have a taller order because you're doing both.
Well, and Jazz, you also have to really keep an eye on all of those, you know, artisans categories too. So it's sort of to keep track of the production design and the costuming and all of the things that make these shows and films tick is a talent as well. So basically, I'm just saying, cheers to both of you as we start this long, long journey. Well, Daniel, you mentioned a couple of these latecomers that are indeed making a lot of noise. Mayor of Easttown, that's sort of become a fun, addictive ride. And to me, it reminds me of Broadchurch to some degree.
Okay.
In sort of the interesting intertwined lives of the people in this small town and the twists and turns. And it's been a fun watch so far. And yeah, that sort of came out of nowhere, but that is a stacked category.
Yeah. And you know, what's interesting about this year with Mayor of Easttown, like if this was a normal non-pandemic year, I'd be sitting here being like, where is my live in-person FYC event where you fly in Wawa? Like you should do that for us. And now I'm like, well, will they be hurt by the fact that they can't do that? They can't have Kate Winslet in person with some people. I don't know. It's not the HFPA, so they won't be as hurt. But I will say, like, I've started to miss some of those live events that, like, now, you know, we're second year in this remote or at least socially distant campaign season. And I'm starting to miss at least the food. I'll just say that.
Well, I did go to the Top Chef drive-in event.
I was not invited to that.
Week.
So, okay.
So.
You have to tell us about that one.
Yeah, you have to, like, I imagine it was like old school diner where they bring the food on skates to your car, no?
It wasn't that elaborate, but what they did do is so it was coincidentally the episode of Top Chef Portland was an episode where the contestants all made drive-in food. So the judges, who were all past contestants, as well as Tom and Gail and Padma, were in their cars, and the two teams had to come up with gourmet drive-in food. And so the winning recipes actually were recreated by the caterers at this drive-in event at the Rose Bowl. So food was pretty good, I gotta say. I mean, it's, you know, at least it sort of, you know, lived up to Top Chef expectations. So that was kind of fun. At least it got us out of the house, and, you know, you're still stuck in your car. It's a little awkward to be eating that kind of food in your car while watching. It's not the perfect sort of event. At least it got, you know, us out of the house as opposed to watching yet another Zoom presentation. But yeah, it's another odd, awkward year for campaigning. And I think you're right. We talked about this when we were talking about the Oscar season, actually, and how maybe if there had been in-person events and campaigning, the Oscar results might have been a little different. Probably the same with Emmys. If there had been in-person events, maybe we'd be talking about a different race. Of course, the race is still young, but I think it's going to help the incumbents. It's going to help the shows that we've been talking about, because it's going to be hard for these late entries to really make a splash when they're not having in-person events. So I think a lot of people have probably already made up their minds, and there's not going to be an in-person experience to change those minds. So who knows? You know, as we keep saying, the season's still young.
It's very true.
You never know. Now that people are starting to get vaccinated, they might do. Like, if you're vaccinated, you can come to the Television Academy and we've got an in-person screen. Who knows what they're going to do? But
maybe for phase two. You know, last year they didn't allow any events for phase two. So perhaps this time, or maybe they're not going to want to deal with the liabilities of doing something like that. But
true.
It's also interesting that, you know, they started banning all the mailers right before the pandemic. And ironically, now's the time where these mailers would actually make a huge difference. So much craziness that's gone on the past 2 years. And that's just another example.
I mean, it is funny that you say the mailers, because literally like 10 minutes before we were logged on to do this, Amazon rang my bell with their FYC juice mailer. This year they did a, you know, every title that is in contention gets its own flavor juice, or I think some of them might be coffees. Last year they did, you know, we're going to paint your show logos onto cookies. So a little more health conscious, you know, 400 days into the pandemic, I think they realized we've all gained a little weight, and they're trying to help us get back into like Emmy gown / suit shape. I don't know. But yeah, it's so sad, but like, those are the things that I think still remind a lot of people about the show, like the physical thing with the name on it, right? Like, it's so easy for people to have an inbox with 1,000 unread emails with links to things that they're never going to get to see. And so, you know, if something shows up at your door that's memorable, I feel like that's what everyone's hoping will make the difference anyway. You know, at least they'll get social media posts out of it, if not actual votes.
Yeah.
Well, it's like on the Amazon juice thing, like I turned it over and it was like The Boys, and you're like, oh yeah, I remember, like that was such a great show. And then the next one was The Underground Railroad, and it was such a great trigger of their slate.
And yeah. I think they did a thing where they were like trying to theme the recipes slightly. Like The Boys one is very bright red, like blood, which I was like, that cannot be a coincidence. I mean, I hope, I don't know. But it was interesting because then, you know, Netflix sent it was just like an old school, looked like a DVD sleeve that had like a QR code on it to say, go to our FYC site. And so it was, you know, not as maybe elaborate as they've done in the past, but it was still like, here's a physical thing to remind you that we're here, which I found really interesting.
Well, even with like the Halston screening yesterday, wasn't elaborate at all. It was a simple, like, there's a delivery coming, and it was just a card for Studio 54. Very simple. They could have gone crazy.
True, yeah, it's Halston. I kind of thought they would have.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the second one that comes at premiere time. Who knows?
Yeah, well, they have to, and the Halston one wasn't Emmy.
No, it was just a regular.
But they do have to be very careful with these. The rules now, nothing can be over $30 in terms of what you're gifting folks. You can't mail anything. So, you know, we're, as members of the press, we're not bound by the TV Academy rules, which is why we're still getting, you know, true, massive cutouts of young Rock, of young Dwayne Johnson to our homes.
Which nobody can see because this is a podcast. Not right. A video, but everybody does need to know that Mike has it posed over his shoulder in the background of his office.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll have to screenshot it.
The Rock is now a member of my family. So. But yeah, so we're getting these, but
true,
for voters,
true.
Voters, you know,
but
they're
getting out the word to the voters.
Yeah, I guess that's our responsibility.
Here's what we're getting. Here's what you're not getting. Yeah. And no, we don't have a selfie with Kate Winslet either. So we're all good.
Yeah.
You know, that raises a good point though, Jazz. Like if, you know, we get things that no one else gets. Sometimes we at Variety get things that other members of the press don't get. We put them on social, like the studios and networks, they want the social post because it, you know, you hashtag the show, it promotes it. But it has to create FOMO for some of these other people. And I almost wonder if sometimes there's backlash. If it's like, well, I didn't get that, so I'm not going to check out your show, or I'm not going to vote on it or watch it or write about it or whatever, depending on who the person saying that is.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And how much, you know, should they be spending, or do they want to spend on these kind of things? And, you know, a lot of them are just, you know, wasteful and you know, they end up in the dumps, and or they send it to me and I don't throw anything away. And
I
now
was just
I have
gonna
to
say, there's no dump at Mike's house. No. Mike has a museum at his
I
house.
Have bins and bins of stuff. The Rock is standing in front of just a smattering of some of the stuff I've collected over the years.
It's a museum, it's not a hoarding space.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, there you go. So what are both of you sort of still looking forward to as you know, this is now the month where the final, you know, contenders are being launched. What have you liked that you've seen, or are you excited for other people to see that's premiering over the next couple of weeks? Danielle?
I mean, I already touched on Hacks, which premieres on May 13th. And that, you know, I love comedy. And I know that when we did our award circuit video for Golden Globe season, you know, we had said something along the lines of like, this is a great time for comedy, because that award season was still kind of filtering some of the 2020 shows in that this Emmy season is not. And so, in all honesty, a few weeks ago, I looked at the Emmy race for comedy and was not excited about it. But then Hacks came along, and I was like, you know what? I'm excited about it again. Like, yes, Ted Lasso's great, but we're not going to only be talking about Ted Lasso. So that's definitely one that I was just surprised by, quite frankly. You know, Jean Smart plays a comedian who kind of had her heyday years ago and has been relegated to a certain shtick, and she hires this young writer who they butt heads. They don't see eye to eye on a lot of what is funny or what women in comedy maybe should be. But they kind of start to rub off on each other. And it's a really interesting look at the stand-up comedy space. So that's one that I am personally very excited about. And this is already airing, but you know, I'm always fascinated to see what Handmaid's Tale does every season. And this season they're doing some things that they kind of promised they would do a while ago, or at least teased that they would do a while ago. And so I'm curious to see how that continues to play out. And you know, where that goes. I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting year. There's still a few things that kind of snuck in under the wire that are surprises to me, like The Bite on Spectrum, you know, Robert and Michelle King's new show. That's sort of pandemic-y, but like it goes a step further. Like it's set in COVID times, but the bite, there's actually like a zombie virus happening in addition to COVID. So that's, I think, going to be a really interesting show. I mean, it's a Spectrum show, so I don't exactly know how hard they're pushing it or how many people will see it before voting, but...
Right. People will watch it 2 years later when it's sold to another platform and
right.
It's not eligible, but...
I don't know. I mean, it's Robert and Michelle King, and I will say that, like, we've been so starved for their content because Good Fight's been gone for so long, Evil has been gone for so long, that I think if they're smart and if they put some money behind it, put some marketing muscle behind it, you know, get that word out there that they've got a new show, and it's just as twisted as some of their other shows. Brain Dead, anybody? Am I the only one that still talks about Brain Dead? Maybe. It's fine.
I remember Brain Dead, but I don't talk about it.
Well, you know, I talk about a lot of things that have died long years ago. So
Danielle's still talking about The Nanny, by the way. Which
I am still. The Nanny is newly on HBO Max. So, and The Nanny, excuse me, was an Emmy winner back in the day. So it's a good show. And if you, you know, if you don't have to watch 500 new shows like I do, you might want to check out an old classic called The Nanny.
Yeah, I'm shocked by the amount of nanny conversation that I've been privy to over the past month. Like, there's a lot of nanny chat. That could be a spinoff podcast. Jazz, how about you? What do you sort of...
I'm excited for Halston just because I love him as a designer. I'm excited to see Ewan McGregor as Halston and just curious to see what, you know, Ryan Murphy has in store. Because I think that it's only 5 episodes. So they're covering pretty much, you know, his entire career in 5 episodes. So I'm curious to see how that works out. But we mentioned it earlier, The Underground Railroad with Nick Britell, who is Barry Jenkins' go-to composer. And Barry Jenkins is coming to TV. It's a 10-part series. I've seen it. I'm, you know, excited for people to... I think, you know, the review embargo has already dropped and it's out there. And really the rest of Pose, I mean, you know, just the origin stories that they're dealing with this season and that finale, Billy Porter is phenomenal.
Pose is a good example of like a show that snuck in for me. I didn't know it would be back this soon. So I didn't think it was going to be Emmy eligible this year. And then, you know, it was kind of that, for me anyway, a surprise, you know, yes, final season, but we're making it. We're getting there. All the episodes will be eligible and ready, and such an emotional journey. Just the show itself ending because of what it's meant, with the void that it's filled on television, but also just what the characters go through in this final season, as we've already started to see. Like, just, I don't know, just tear-jerking television for me, which is cathartic in a way, I guess.
And now also with the premiere party in New York, sort of sounded like it was quite an adventure. People are talking about it even more. So
exactly.
You know,
definitely. I think it's been cathartic for them as well, you know, making it, coming through it and, you know, having some things to say about this business.
Yeah. Well, I was excited to see Hacks. And, you know, again, it is the year of Jean Smart. And for someone to be coming off, you know, so many recent great roles like Watchmen, to now be on, you know, 2 buzzy shows on as we speak, pretty incredible. So I'm kind of excited for her and excited for both of those shows. Personally, I was very excited also to see the return of Mythic Quest, season 2, which was another one of those just sort of feel good, but still really interesting comedies with, you know, fascinating characters, a lot of comedy, a lot of heart that is not expected. You know, so I kind of put that show in the same category as, say, the Ted Lassos and some of the other comedies that we've been seeing lately. So that was nice to see. But yeah, so again, these last minute additions, shaking up these categories a little bit, you know, and it's kind of making me sad. Some of the shows I thought were sure things for a limited series will be kind of pushed out now because of some of these new entries, but we're seeing an interesting resurgence in attention for small acts, which I think is great. And coincidentally, John Boyega is our leadoff guest this week on the show. Had a great conversation with him. And then later we'll be, Danielle, you'll be talking to Z-Way, who also is a sensation.
And a new entry in the race.
Yeah. So some fresh faces on the first TV installment of the Award Circuit podcast.
Yay.
Thanks, gang. See you next week. It's Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. I'm Michael Schneider. Amazon Prime Video's Small Acts is a 5-film anthology from director Steve McQueen, set from the late 1960s to the mid-1980s inside London's West Indian community. The films each tell a different story about the power of truth and resistance in the midst of racism and discrimination. And yes, the stories feel just as timely today. In the film Red, White, and Blue, McQueen tells the true story of Leroy Logan, a young forensic scientist who decides he wants to create change from within by becoming a police officer. But in doing so, he faces both the disapproval of his father, played by Steve Toussaint, the fact that he's still seen as a traitor by his community, and the blatant racism he still finds inside the Metropolitan Police Force.
At least this way, Dad, I can change things. Get out of my house!
Out there, it is us and them. That's how it works.
Stop, police! I'm out there with no backup!
Sometimes I think the earth needs to be scorched. You planted. Something good will come of him.
John Boyega stars as Leroy Logan, who went on to a celebrated career inside the force, where he became one of London's top officers before retiring a few years ago. I spoke to Boyega via Zoom as he was down in New Orleans about to start work on a new project. I began by asking Boyega to share how he's faring as we slowly emerge from the pandemic and what the mood was like down in the Big Easy.
I just came out of quarantine, so, you know, I'm just, you know, finding my feet, getting accustomed with the environment. I've never been here before, so it's just, I'm just getting to know everything, really.
You've never been to New Orleans?
Yeah, never been, no.
Oh,
no.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's my first time.
Hopefully you'll get to experience some of it.
I'm hearing about Essence Fest and all these carnivals that I've been, you know, that obviously with the pandemic, now I've come at the wrong time, but hopefully I can see some stuff, man.
Yeah, yeah, the music, the food, that'll be awesome, awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this. You killed it in Small Axe. That was such an incredible performance and project for you. So I wanted to kind of get in on that. But first, sort of just see how you are doing. This has been quite a year, obviously, for everyone. But how has this year been for you? And sort of as we're hopefully kind of getting out of this pandemic, how are you doing?
Yeah, I've just been navigating. I've been away from home for a bit. I had some long time away from family, and then we reconnected. So this whole journey with the pandemic actually put life on hold and changed dynamics and changed a lot of things. But I honestly, you know, really, really can't complain at all. You know, actually fine through it. You know, just been trying to adapt and change like everybody else, you know.
No, absolutely. And it sounds like things are slowly kind of getting back to normal for you as well.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a little bit about Small Axe. And when Steve McQueen first sort of approached you for this, how did he kind of describe what this was going to be? It's such a unique project for him, these individual films, and really ambitious what he wanted to do here. How did he kind of pitch it to you?
Well, he told me that he was doing a number of films and they would all be released at the same time. He was still kind of working on what the format would be specifically. I think there was still conversations being cooked up. But he gave me an idea of this kind of new way of releasing a series of these stories and the characters that he wanted to portray and the people, the real life people, real life situations that were real pivotal part of, you know, Black British history. And he wanted to really put it out there in this very unique package of films. And I was just obviously just like, okay, this dude is crazy genius, which is always a good thing in our industry, especially in the industry of creatives. But at the same time, I just really believed in the goal. And the goal was to shine a light on stories that haven't been told before, that are kind of missing from the history books of film, that what Steve was said in our last kind of interview, they're kind of missing from the history of film. And this insight was truly important and an insight that I feel like would be referenced to in years to come just because of its unique perspective. And I was just honestly excited by his expression about his experience growing up, the types of stories for, you know, from the other films as well, and how that kind of like led him to that choice to want to be a part of it. And then I just kind of like, you know, signed on to his creative vision and we were a go.
Yeah. No, yeah. And it is stories that, you know, obviously, especially us in the U.S. haven't seen before, in particular. So the Black experience in the U.K., but also the West Indian immigrant experience.
Yes, yeah.
A lot of that just hadn't been seen. And you know, here in the United States, we're so insular. We're so focused on America and the stories of the U.S. that we often sort of miss the you know, what's going on overseas, and especially over the past year. When did you shoot this, by the way?
We shot this 2000. Well, we done some reshoots in early 2020, didn't we? And we shot this maybe like end of 2019, you know, because I remember it was getting cold at the time. So maybe end of 2019 and then reshoots 2020.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, and I'm sure you get the question a lot. I mean, the timing of this coming out, A, during the pandemic, but also B, during the national conversation that we're having in the U.S. right now about police brutality, about white supremacy and the impact on that, not just here in the U.S. but globally as well. It's always a discussion that needs to be had, but for it to be happening right when Small Axe came out, sort of interesting timing as well. You were so powerful last year in Hyde Park. Talk a little bit about that moment and sort of what made you decide to go out there and say your piece and grab that megaphone and say something.
I think first and foremost, I'm Black, and that means a lot to me when I say that. I feel like sometimes when people get in a certain position, the curiosity of why somebody would speak up and speak out is, they're so curious about it. And I'm kind of like, you know, I still have family, you know, I still have people, friends and even distant acquaintance I have, you know, special love for, that are still vulnerable to these situations, regardless of, you know, where I come from. So first off, that's the thing, is that your own, you know, experience, you know, and the second thing really is just the sorrow that it gives you to see Black bodies continuously treated that way. I have a closer relation to that kind of issue, because that looks like my uncle down there, that looks like my father. And so the kind of uproar, even though it was global, you know, people from all different races and creeds came up and stood out. The cry from the Black perspective is specific to that, you know, specific to that issue. And so it moves you regardless of your situation. And I wasn't even there. I wasn't supposed to speak. We had actually been protesting about three to four hours prior to the speech. But I guess being there more and more, relating to people that have been through this scenario situation, and then finally waiting for Belly Majinga's family to come up, and because her sister was going to come and give her speech and her thanks, I was given the megaphone to kind of speak, and that was just what was naturally on my mind, you know.
Yeah, and I remember you said at the time, of course, that you were concerned that, you know, you weren't concerned. It didn't really matter how this impacted your career. The important thing was to say this, and I remember thinking at the time, actually, It's so important to hear John Boyega say this, and there's a generation of kids who know who you are, and to see John Boyega go up and grab a megaphone and say this was even more powerful for this young generation to hear that coming out of you. What sort of reaction did you get from people in the days after?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people speak about it and speak on this, but you know, for me, my mind is, you know, those are words. If you know, action and you know, consistency isn't added, and so it's all good and well being the inspiration behind words, but also it adds more important and emphasis on the reality of working towards those changes and being a part of it, aligning my goals, which some of which have nothing to do with no movement or nothing. Some of which I just want to be a great actor, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But aligning that with things that, you know, uplifts other people is giving birth to a real true passion in me, you know, especially after the protest. So, you know, that in itself is the biggest gift, you know, and the biggest kind of reflection and reaction that I get, you know, when I meet people out and about.
Yeah. Well, it's when I think about Small Axe and
even the title Small Acts, it means so many different things, right? It's like small acts, these are small stories, so these are acts of stories, but then also that whole idea of like these acts of courage and resistance that you know are each small in their own little ways, but they need to add up, and they start to add up, and it can be really disheartening to see the headlines, to see what's going on even right now at this moment, these past few weeks here in the United States. It could be really disheartening, but then you got to remember, it's like these acts along the way that everyone's doing to sort of hopefully push us to a better place.
Yeah, no, definitely. And it's, you know, it's also stopping ourselves from being mere spectators of these movements and situations, and really trying to align our own goals. Cause you know, it's not only celebrities and people with platforms that are important in this. It's actually, when you think about it, they're there to just attract the masses because of their access. But you are the masses, you know, it's so important that everybody gets that message.
Well, the cool thing about your story was learning Leroy Logan, learning who he was, and you know, discovering, you know, his whole history. Because obviously, you know, you got to meet him, you got to get to know him a little bit. So that must have been just fascinating to sort of learn his motivations, his world, especially in the 1980s. He's been very complimentary to you. He really feels like that must make you extra proud too, as he feels like you pulled it off. But take me back to first learning his story and sort of what were some of the things that you thought about as you sort of researched who he was, especially in those early days when he did something that, you know, not a lot of people would have done.
Yeah. So it's funny you say that was the key for me. See, this guy has made a decision that a lot of people would have made, especially during that time. And I was curious as to what kind of mind is behind a man that kind of makes this choice. So our first conversation was leaning towards that, but also I related to him in various different ways. Because, you know, growing up and the work that youth work and the drama club stuff that he did, you know, in and around South London, I was involved in those groups and those drama clubs too. So we could relate on various different situations and issues, especially when we spoke up about things just based on a unique experience. But you know, it was great just meeting him and knowing his true mind and his thoughts while he was going through these crazy stuff. Like I was asking him real, you know, stuff that I can't really say on air, but real raw questions about the scenarios or what he was thinking, you know, how could possibly reacted. And so it was a revelation for real.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of like a man without a country. I mean, his community thought he was a traitor. But then he wasn't accepted in the force. So he's sort of an island to himself. There's no one really there to support him that's superhuman to be able to pull that off and you know, continue. And the thing is, you showed sort of the conflict that was inside him. He had a resolve, which was incredible to see, but there's still that conflict and there's still that moment. Everyone's human. And that moment where they do get when you're like, why didn't you back me up? Why weren't you there? And, you know, there is that split second where, you know, if I were Leroy, I probably would have just ended it all right there. Just like, screw it. I'm done with you and I'm done with this. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, that resolve to still move forward is something that was so unique. And how did you find that as an actor? What was sort of your motivation as you were sort of, you know, portraying that?
Well, to be honest, I was just led through the dialogue, led through the character, you know, led through my understanding of Leroy and the reason why he had these kind of thought processes. And because he felt that it was worth, you know, being given up his career as a scientist and going into policing because it was of benefit to the community down the line. You know, there'd be more representation that would hopefully motivate other people to join. And that thinking, you know, that community thinking is quite unique to, and it's not for everybody. A lot of people don't, you know, think in that way. And to know that he thought in that way, I was going deeper and deeper into that thinking and following that, knowing that of him while portraying him, you know, it was easy to then be like, okay, cool. Yeah. These are the choices that Leroy would make. And this is why.
Have you talked to him since it came out and has he sort of described?
I haven't.
No.
I mean, I've only been able to manage to message him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I mean, that must really, if you're him, he must. I mean, it's to finally tell the story and to explain to people this is why I did this, and you know, I'm sure this has probably meant so much to him, and everything I've read him say seems like it really meant a lot.
No, exactly. You know, but even during now, when there seems to be much more than back in the day, much more black individuals signing up to be part of the force. Not near enough, but. There's a lot more people who are keen to take on those jobs, you know, and yeah, I have a few friends that actually are as well. And that in itself is an interesting narrative, but to be the person at the front lines from the beginning, when it was just a fresh new idea, something that people had never really even seen. That's different.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially given his relationship with his father, which is the other really fascinating thing about this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that relationship that you portray on screen with Stephen Toussaint, like that chemistry between the two of you, the back and forth, there's a lot that's said. You don't even have to have dialogue at times. That ending where the two of you are just sitting there,
pouring
a drink, and that there's some powerful stuff in there. You know, talk a little bit about that too, and playing this complicated father son relationship that you know is also at the heart of this story.
Mm-hmm. I think it was brilliant and beautiful playing that. Me and Stephen used to collaborate a lot. Me, Stephen, and Steve would talk a lot about our own fathers, our relation to our dads, the ups and downs in those kind of relationships, you know, when, you know, how things change when you start getting older, the way you see your father, you know, when you see him vulnerable for the first time. We discussed so many things. And I think that really, really helped the scenes. There was... we were all on the same page in terms of how you get emotionally when those stuff are going down between you and your dad, and there's disagreements, especially a lifelong disagreement. You know, we were expressive about our own experiences, and so I guess in those scenes without dialogue, it's a lot of emotions channeled in because we were talking about this daily.
Yeah, I bet, and you know, all of these stories that Steve McQueen told were so personal, you know, and so. What were some of the other kind of conversations you had with him in terms of sort of, you know, direction that he gave or sort of his thoughts along the way?
Well, we had loads of conversations. We would talk about everything, really, just about the political climate. We talk about, you know, our views on various different things, the change, you know, how change would come about, entertainment, changing entertainment. These are all conversations that naturally happen on set, you know, with everyone as well. A lot of people do add their own two piece to these conversations. So we were talking about a hell of a lot, especially with the scenes, you know, as they came about, the scenes would always prompt, you know, a conversation upon a conversation. Sometimes it'll be stories, you know, stories from his past, his childhood, stories from my childhood that are just funny, you know, it's got nothing to do with nothing. But just reminds us of memories, because that's what you're going through when you really go into small acts in those films. You actually understand that these are like sacred memories for a lot of people who were in the UK, early 80s, you know, getting down there and having these experiences.
Yeah. And you mentioned sort of like taking your personal stories. What in particular from your personal background sort of did you really dig into? When it came to this character and this story in particular?
Well, really more about what I discussed with Leroy, which was going, being at the drama clubs that a lot of these officers, whether they would be officers or since retired detectives, who would come in and speak at these communities, like really experiencing the change that Leroy fought for is quite interesting, you know, because now I'm obviously an actor portraying him, but in real life, I was one of the kids that kind of benefited off of that kind of change that he tried to kickstart. You know, I would go and I felt anyway that I had a cool and solid relationship with a lot of our community leaders, and some of which had a history of being in the police force or being in law enforcement in some type of way. So that was a cool connection for me.
Yeah. Did you, was that something you would ever have considered, law enforcement?
Hell no, man. raising the sticks, man. We don't do that.
Yeah.
Nah, man, nah. But I think there's other ways of doing it. That's why I was so curious. You know, me and Steve, man. Even Steve, me and Steve were like we had to. I was so curious to ask him what was motivating you, and then understanding and representing this guy. It was cool to understand his perspective. But we all have our different ways of doing it, and yeah, mine ain't that.
I did like that they managed to get like a little Star Wars reference in the screen.
That's deep. That is deep. Yeah. To this day, I don't feel like I reacted the way I should have reacted. I was supposed to be like one of these professional actors and be like, you know, don't you think that's too much? I don't know, man. I was like, you know what? Why not? I don't know. You know, I saw it in there and said it. That's why in the scene, it just kind of goes over Leroy dead, literally. I was just like, oh, well, all right. So after I was asked by it, it's like, yeah, it is a Star Wars reference, isn't it?
Yeah, the Jedi reference. I mean, it was low-hanging fruit, but sometimes you got to do that, right? Sometimes.
It felt cheeky, but I was like, okay, you know, I'll let you have that one.
Whatever. Yeah. And you got to give it to the audience, right? It's like it's a gimme for the audience. Like,
exactly, that's what it is, mate.
They got the reference. What I know you've talked a lot about sort of your complicated feeling now about that franchise. Where are you now in terms of, you know, sort of now that there's a little time has passed since that's all, you know, been out there. Kind of your feelings now in terms of that franchise, your experience with it, and sort of how you're now using that going forward and what you do, what you want to do as an actor.
Well, it's definitely helped influencing, you know, collaborations and stuff, you know. I'm at a good place, you know, just working with, you know, people like I want to work with and making sure I'm more strict with the type of roles I go for. You know, it definitely affects a lot of things, but really the energy is on moving forward and moving on. And I think Red, White and Blue was a big incubator for that and a big supporter of that, because that's kind of like the role fresh out of the franchise. That's kind of like the role that kickstarts what I see as like a new kind of path for me, you know, where I actually can utilize the opportunities effectively.
Yeah. So you're looking to do more dramatic, like roles, like what are you kind of looking
at? Yeah, more dramatic. But to be honest, like, you know, I say that sometimes, you know, skill set is like currency, man, you know, and if you've got a variety of skill sets, you could do a variety of accents, most likely you're going to have a variety of things that you would want to pick up on. So, and at this rate, I just want to be in things I like watching. I like watching a lot of stuff. Yeah. So, you know, I've got so many dramas, and, you know, I've never been on screen in a romantic comedy before. I've never done that.
You know, there you
never,
go. Yeah.
Done a historical epic. There's so many things that, you know, I'm curious about.
Yeah, it's kind of like you already have the action figure. You already have the action figure, so you can kind of like, you know.
Yeah, you know, you get to the top and then you go, oh, there's a little sidestep to another mountain.
Yeah.
And you go that way.
Yeah, I totally think romantic comedy is the way to go. So
yeah, man, you know, I'm so curious, you know, there's so much amazing writers right now coming up and directors too that are coming into the game too. So it's just like, you know, if I get the opportunity, I do, you know, just trying to keep my ears to the ground.
So what are you watching these days? What do you like? What sort of over the pandemic, was it anything binged or?
Just finished Them on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was. I'm still processing that one.
That one's gotten a lot of attention for being it's a hard watch.
Yeah, I'm still processing that, because I also I came from, you know, in drama school and drama class, it was like the expression of art and storytelling was a big emphasis for us. And so I'm trying to understand also the creative choices too. But it's a lot. But I've just finished that last night.
So what else over the pandemic did you have time to watch? Anything you went back to that maybe you missed the first time around?
Oh yeah, I went back to City of God. Mm-hmm. I went back to the first Coming to America.
Ah, yeah. I
watched the sequel, and that made me, I had to go back to the first, made me want to go watch the first one.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen it in a long time. And then I was watching some like some real kind of like cool black classics, like, you know, The Woods, Two Can Play That Game, Boys in the Hood. I was just watching all the stuff I liked watching growing up, you know.
Yeah. Well, you know, since we're talking, this is for Emmys, Emmy season. Are there any things in particular that maybe folks you'd love to see nominated? Maybe you want to compete against, you know, who would you like to see out there in the race as we start to celebrate this year's TV shows?
I'm the worst at this, because I'll be honest with you, I still find it tricky how these things bloody freaking work. I'm supposed to, what they say, you're supposed to do like what? At least 20 years in the game before you can talk about these things specifically, right? I don't know, man. I don't even know if I've been up to date. Someone did mention Queen's Gambit. I need to get on top of that. Because I do like the lead girl in that. She was really good. Really, really good.
Yeah.
I've seen some other stuff too. But yeah, I have a bunch of catching up to be. Probably when I see them, I'll remember. But right now, I'm just like, I don't even know.
Did you watch Bridgerton?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. It's, you know.
You're not going to be trying season 3 of Bridgerton.
It's fun. Yeah. I heard they're not bringing my guy back, though.
No, Regé Jean. Well, he's on to big things. I mean, that the goal is, like, now everyone's talking about him as the next James Bond, right? That's,
yeah, like watching him, he has a great energy about him. You know, just in terms of, you know, when there's a presence of someone on screen, like, he has a good, solid presence from what I caught from Bridgerton. But yeah, man, you know, I stay off the horses for now.
Yeah. Well, congrats, man. Again, I think you're right. Small Axe was such a great revelation for you to show, like, you know, some serious acting chops. I mean, it was amazing to watch those scenes and to see, like, the inner turmoil of Leroy portrayed like that. And you've got to be really proud of how that turned out. Yeah. And so good luck with the film in New Orleans. Go get some good food, get some po' boys.
I heard, man. I'll try.
Yeah,
when I'm done with the job,
get some Cajun food. Go see some live jazz. Hopefully, it's all like back out and happening there. But yeah, have a great time down there.
No, thank you, man. Much appreciated, dude.
Steve McQueen's Small Axe, including the installment Red, White, and Blue, starring John Boyega, is now streaming on Amazon Prime Video. After the break, Danielle Terciano introduces you to your new late night appointment TV, Z-Way. This is the Award Circuit Podcast. And we're back. It's the Award Circuit Podcast. I'm Michael Schneider. The comedian and author who goes professionally by just her first name, Z-Way, went viral last summer when she hosted the Instagram live show From My Bedroom. Not only hosting and interviewing guests from Alyssa Milano to Allison Roman, but also handling the show's set design, hair and makeup, costume design, and talent booking. Now, with a new platform on Showtime and a partnership with producers at A24, she finally has collaborators and plans to scale things up. Z-Way calls the series a variety show in the truest sense, featuring sketches, music videos, and field pieces where she talks to real New Yorkers about race, in addition to interviews with such celebrity guests as Fran Lebowitz, Adam Pally, Bowen Yang, and Ebony K. Williams. Variety's Danielle Terciano recently spoke with Z-Way about the overall universe she's creating. They began by discussing what she wanted to change for the new format.
I think this new process is inherently more collaborative because I'm working with the whole team at A24 and as well as Showtime. So suddenly I'm not producing an interview show from my bedroom where I'm also doing set design and HMU and costume design and talent booking. Now there's a full-fledged team to help me and work and collaborate. And so that's really been a blessing, is that I'm able to scale the show up to the level in which I think it deserves.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's not just all interviews. Like, you have some really fun sketches. You have some, like, they're not like fully man on the street, but they are like you interacting with regular people.
Totally.
What went into doing it that way and not just doing like a straight talk show the way that you were kind of doing on Instagram?
Sure. I mean, Instagram Live is inherently going to be two people talking and then audience members commenting. Whereas with this Showtime by A24 show, it's the world is open up. So I have music videos as well as field pieces where I'm talking to real people who are New Yorkers about race. And that kind of feels in line with the comedy that I've been doing as a live performer in New York for, you know, the last 5, 6, 7 years. And so I was really excited to bring that humor to the forefront of my work as well. So you're really going to see like a variety show in the truest sense. Like it hits all of the different beats. If you like produce interviews versus live versus field pieces versus sketches, like you're really going to see it all.
And I mean, speaking to that, you know, there's obviously different levels, I think, of comedy that you can do with those different formats, but you have this really important quote in your trailer just about, you know, the kinds of humor, but that there are serious topics. So I'm curious, like, where you play in terms of where you want to bring in actual jokes versus where, you know, maybe there is something that's funny because the person's reaction is funny. And maybe it's not, it doesn't need to be as scripted or as written.
Totally. I think ultimately comedy for me is how I heal through trauma. So while there are some things you shouldn't joke about, I like to use laughter as a device to make me feel better about the world. And so when thinking about the respective conversations and topics, it's really, you know, we really try to push the boundaries of what's acceptable on television because that's the most fun. That's what excites me as a performer, as a writer, as a producer. So you're really going to see us get right up to the line and hopefully not cross it. And if we do, we apologize. But yeah, it's going to be really, really wild and bombastic and silly.
It's funny. I don't think you have to apologize. Like if you cross the line, like it's honest, it's real, you know, and you can't control what your guests are going to say. And you used to always ask your guests, like, why do you come on the show? Yeah. Is that a conversation that you felt like you had to have before you even invited them onto the Showtime show to make sure that they were coming on for the right reasons?
No, not at all. I started asking my guests on the Instagram Live show why they did the show because I would get that all the time in the press. Whereas in this respective show, people have seen enough of my work on YouTube as well as in Instagram Live. So they have a general idea of what they're getting into. And it's also not the live immediacy of, you know, 10,000 people commenting how many Black friends they have. So it's a little different, but I what's really exciting is that all of my respective guests, like Fran Lebowitz and Phoebe Bridgers, and Bowen Yang and Patty Harrison, they're all really quite brave and funny. And you're going to see the sort of vulnerability that it cannot be imitated on any other interview show. So it's really like Fran Lebowitz for the first time in some ways.
Mm. You know, it's interesting that you put it that way because, you know, you obviously are asking them questions I'm sure they're not expecting. But some of them come in with a level of performance themselves. What did it take for you to kind of knock those walls down so that they were not performing in the interview?
I think ultimately it's just about active listening for me as an interviewer, whatever the response is. If I'm talking to Bowen Yang about his experiences, you know, just taking that in and then asking follow-up questions because it's a real conversation in real time. So we are creating this art together in the same space and it's live and I'm surprised as often as they're surprised. So it's really about staying in the moment and like letting the comedy prevail by the awkwardness and tension of each respective answer.
Mm-hmm. And are there certain people who came on and said like, I don't want to delve into certain topics. Like I don't want to be asked how many Black friends I have. I don't want to be asked to name Asian people. Like what are the rules that they were allowed to, or parameters that they were allowed to set, if any?
No, honestly, everyone was game to play because they, I believe that my guests kind of respect the idea that it's not about trapping anybody or getting them canceled. It's about having really productive conversations that are ultimately funny and healing. So everyone was really down to clown. And it, honestly, you're going to see that fun and humor in real time. It's really, really special.
You have some really fun sketches as well. And I know that like the audience has only seen little clips of them so far based on the trailer, but like there's, you know, the American Girl sketch where I imagine you're going to do some animation with dolls and it's going to be a little bit more than just the actors. What goes into like, how do you find that creativity? Like, how do you tap into that's a sketch versus like, I have something I want to say about that, but that's a sketch.
Oh, I think it's just, how do you visualize? Because I, again, when I'm interviewing my respective guests, I can't control what their answers are. I'm just getting it in real time and I'm surprised. But with a respective sketch like American Girl Dolls with Jane Krakowski and Kristen Milioti, we are able to craft an idea and really hone in on the satire of what we're trying to criticize. And so that's just about like that. That's an idea that came to me a couple of years ago. And then I, you know, gave one sentence idea to Cola Scola and they took it away and ran with it. So it's really about collaboration and what is feels like more of a visual joke than more of like an interview question and finding the balance between the two, like Stop Being Poor, for example, that's a music video I did with Patty Harrison. And so that just kind of came from the idea, which was like last, during the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of Americans were losing their jobs and they had no way of, you know, paying for their homes and they were getting evicted. And it, and the response in, you know, public discourse was like, hey, figure it out. Sorry. Good luck. The stimulus check will come when it comes.
Right.
And that's, I reacted to that. Like I was really heartbroken by that. I just don't understand how you can kind of treat citizens like that. And so that's the really silly song where we're dancing in like matching tennis suits with fake diamonds and we're rapping about stop being poor, but it's about like the serious satire of like the last year in American politics. So ultimately it's like, what are we trying to say and how are we trying to say it in a way that's palatable and enjoyable and lighthearted? Because again, it's always a comedy show first.
And I mean, what is the process like in terms of when these things get formulated? Is it, you know, oh, I did all the interviews first and then realized I had all these other things I wanted to say that I didn't get to in the interviews? Or are you working concurrently? How are you balancing, I guess, you know, the different topics that you're putting into each episode?
Sure. So we started the writers room before the interviews or guests were even locked. We had ideas of who we wanted, but we kind of figured that out with the pandemic. Who's even in New York? Who's willing to get on a set and be surrounded by 70
people?
Good
point, yeah.
But as far as the topics of each respective interviews, which is wealth and allyship and 55% of white women and whitewashing, we kind of came up with those topics first. And then we developed the sketches and the music videos and the questions for the respective guests after the fact. Mm-hmm. And so it was really about like, how do we refine what we're trying to say through a lens so it's clear and consistent and doesn't feel so sporadic?
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned early in our conversation, like the partnership, not just with your writers, but with A24 and with Showtime. And so because you have that, you have a different platform than you've had before, but I imagine you also have different people to answer to in a way that you didn't have to before. So were there things that you felt like you actually had to scale back on or just maybe ask the questions in different ways because you knew, you know, hey, there's a corporation attached to this?
Totally. Honestly, again, it goes back to the idea that we're never trying to cancel anybody or ruin their lives. So it's been a pleasure working with H24 and Showtime, who have been nothing but supportive of my visions and have encouraged me to actually go further where I'm like, well, actually, I'm not that radical. So it's been really exciting to see the ebbs and flow of the collaborative process with these two really prominent companies. But I've had a pleasure, honestly.
Wait, I do want to, I have to pick up on that. Like where are you not radical enough for them? What were those areas?
A lot of sketches that, you know, might see the light of day season two. Always over time. To me, this is about a journey, right? And so it's like, you've got to walk before you run. And so every single episode feels like it's building upon itself in a language. So our last episode, I believe, is whitewashing, where our first episode is 55% of white women. And so Fran Lebowitz and Adam Pally. And so there are little Easter eggs throughout each respective interview and each respective episode, because they're all connected and we're slowly building this like cinematic universe. It's the Z-Way cinematic universe that we're constructing together. So it's like there are more jokes to come always, but we're working through it every single day.
Yeah. And I mean, it is still very early, obviously, in the show's journey. What do you feel like the landscape of variety sketch / late night lacked that your show is now adding?
What did it like? You know what, I believe we're in a renaissance of comedy, honestly, with Amber Ruffin and Desus Romero and Sam Jay And I think you should leave. There's so many, and Eric Andre's Bad Trip, that was a phenomenal film. So I think there's a lot of really good comedy out there. So I'm really honored to join the greats in our contribution to like the comedic discourse. And as far as what I think my show adds, I think it is a fundamental deconstruction of what a typical quote unquote late night interview is. Where formerly it was like, okay, I'm doing this movie about grass. And here are my grass anecdotes. You're really never going to get those plug and play answers. Yeah. Show everything during my Fran Lebowitz interview, for example, there were several times where she said, quote, I've never been asked this before. And this is a woman who's been in the public sphere for 40 or 50 years. And so to hear Fran Lebowitz, who's talked to Toni Morrison and David Letterman and so many other, Jimmy Fallon, so many other brilliant comedians and authors and writers, and artists, and say, hey, I've never been asked that before. That's where I'm really proud of what our show is doing. Because again, I want to bring a fresh new take, but shout out to everyone who's currently making comedy. I think there's a lot of really good comedy if you're a comedy lover out there.
But I really like the way you said, like, it's not going to be a plug and play, right? Because like, you don't have to have somebody on who's just promoting a movie or a TV show. Like if you're having conversations that are topical about race or about class or about like the pandemic, literally that's everybody. That affects everybody, which
totally
feels like it makes it harder though to choose who you have on in a way. I mean, I don't know. I mean, did you have a certain guideline or like a wish list, or how did you even choose, I guess, who to collaborate with?
Sure. I mean, yes and no, because what you'll see on the show, like there's this one field piece that we do, it's called Woke Wars, where I interview New Yorkers about whether or not they're woke. And these are regular people who are not performers in any way. And their answers are just as funny, if not funnier, than the seasoned performers. So I think that everyone has an interesting perspective that they bring to conversations about race that are funny. So I could talk to a tree stump and it would be interesting. With that being said, because each episode was themed around wealth or around whitewashing or around allyship, there are certain guests that are 55% of white women. There are certain guests that you immediately think of because they'd be great for this theme, who really highlight the theme in a really powerful way. Hearing what Fran Lebowitz thinks about electoral politics is really compelling. So yes and no, it's really a give and take. But to speak to the topicality of the show, there is this really famous late night host called Dick Cavett, and he used to interview James Baldwin. And I actually returned to those interviews every month. And while they were shot, you know, 30 years ago, I find them to be more topical now than what they were in the days of yore. So I'm really hoping that the interviews that I have sort of, they last for years to come, because these are still pertinent issues, whether it's the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, or 2024 or 2030. So yeah.
And I have to say, I mean, the idea of you asking New Yorkers those questions, I want to see you come out and ask LA people those questions.
I know.
You would get would be very different and very funny in different ways.
Totally. Exactly. It's like, and when we're writing, we're constructing these ideas, we're not going into it being like, okay, this is the joke. We are finding that in person, in the practicality of shooting. And then again, in the edit. So I would love the fluidity of like a Woke Wars Tampa Bay, a Woke Wars Alberta, Canada.
Right, right.
You know, I think it's because every single locale, whether you're from the North, the East, or abroad, has a different interpretation of race. And I think that that's what keeps the show fresh and new and also infinite.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're speaking to like kind of an evergreenness to it too, when you're saying that you want these interviews to last. So how did you approach things that are a little bit more specific, like the pandemic or like, you know, the George Floyd, first the murder, but then we just had Derek Chauvin's trial. Like, were those topics that you wanted to touch at all?
Yeah, I think, I mean, in the specificity, there is evergreenness. So for example, the pandemic, that the stop being poor, that's Reaganomics. That goes back to 1980, but it's still pertinent in this day and age, because, you know, the more things change, the more things stay the same. So I think the key with different topics is hitting at what exactly is going on and how does this apply to the greater American public. And when you start to pull those through lines, you realize that it's not just about this moment in time. It's about this schema in society, this like reoccurring theme that's unfortunate.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I mean, you are very busy, obviously, like with this show. You're talking about all these really important topics, but then you're also writing a book, or maybe you have finished it by now. I'm not sure.
I submitted my first draft actually on Saturday.
Oh, congrats. That's
awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, it's like,
exactly. But like, to me, the balancing of these two things, especially if you have all of these ideas floating in your head, is there a need to like compartmentalize and say, I'm saving this idea for the show, I'm saving this idea for the book? How do you approach those various pieces of what you do?
Totally. I think it's again, it's about medium, right? There are things that you would post on Twitter that you wouldn't post on TikTok.
Sure.
So there, for me, it's the
yeah, things I'm that a little old for TikTok, but thank you.
Honestly, I'm like, how do those kids edit? Really, truly. But so similar. So basically TikToks are, books are the TikToks of print. And so basically it's like, there are things that you can write and really verbalize that you might want to visualize on your show. And these themes are so connected. I'm talking about race in my book as well. Mm-hmm. And I talk about my experiences in the pandemic and my interpretations of like the racial uprisings of last year. But you're going to see that written versus you're seeing a sketch or you're seeing me ask a respective guest about it. So it's really about the different mediums and kind of conforming to them, because it's like people ingest in different ways. Mm-hmm. If it's a song, it's, you know, it has to rhyme. It's in these couplets, it's a catchy beat, but obviously you don't need a catchy beat if you're doing a sketch with Jane Krakowski. So it depends on the medium.
Okay, it's funny that you phrased it that way, because like, you could, she sings, you could make
she,
it.
And she's very, she's a really brilliant actress. We worked together on Dickinson as well, and I'm always kind of like dumbfounded seeing her work in person, because wow, like she really is like she's so brilliant, she's so sharp.
So It's a really fun entrance, I think, for you into late night with this episode that you've kind of been teasing already in terms of the sketches and the interviews. Do you feel like you're going to be changed in any way when the show premieres? Do you feel like, you know, this platform that Showtime is giving you, being different from what you've already had, is going to make you think about things differently or react differently on social? How do you feel like you're going to be different after this experience?
I don't know how I will be different, but that's the thing about changing, is that it's sort of gradual. But I'm open every day. I am open to learning and becoming a better person. And I recognize that there's so much I don't even know that I don't know. So my hope is that at the end of this journey, whenever it is finished, that I come out of it a wiser person, able to go forth in my respective communities and really help and not hurt.
And do you feel like this is a open door situation, in the sense of like, people see that you have done this and now maybe there are people who can come up behind you and also reach this new audience as well?
Definitely. I mean, so I show run my show. And so yeah, that's one of my goals, is to hire a lot of first time writers and first time producers, and give them the opportunities that, you know, it would have taken them a couple more years to break through. And so that's my hope, like on the like literal level of employing people, as well as on like a public level of like people seeing my work and saying, hey, how can I interpret this? I know that when I watch like Colbert Report, and when I watch Oprah Winfrey, and when I see Eric Andre, and each of these different artists are pushing boundaries in their lane in right, such unique ways that all influence my work. Oprah as an interviewer, Colbert Report as this satirist, and then Eric Andre as this like sort of visceral, in your face, like really, really spontaneous performer, with Desus Mero in the same category. That makes me the comedian that I am today. Mm-hmm. And so I hope that people watch my comedy and are influenced to make their own special comedy, because that's my goal, is to inspire people to self-actualize.
And I guess maybe the way I phrased it was also unfair, because like, it's not to say that, you know, having a platform on YouTube or Instagram, being an influencer and a comedian in those spaces is not as good. I am curious too, if you feel like there is a difference, if there is a sense of, you know, some influencers, that's where they want to stay. You know, maybe mainstream or premium cable, which has a limited audience, isn't for everyone. How do you approach, I guess, the advice you give to people who are in those different spaces?
I think, I mean, there's a lot of freedom that comes with being an influencer, right? Which is that, so sure, you answer to your sponsors, but you're also on a schedule that you create. You shoot when you want. You shoot a lot of the times in your house. When I was doing my Instagram live show, it's like, oh, if I don't want to do it, I just don't have to do it because I'm accountable to myself and my audience. Whereas with a network behind you, there's suddenly more people you have to converse with to get this product made. And where I could shoot an interview and it's live, like literally live.
Right.
This is a process that we shot for 15 days in February and it's airing now in May, which is a quick turnover, but still that's some time in between. So to answer your, your question is,
the advice that you give to different
influencers, you know, live your lives, do your thing. I think the best advice I could give to influencers is being, authentic, which sounds like really bad, dumb advice, but I think there, especially on the internet, there is an inclination to sort of follow the trends. How do you get viral? This is the way that someone went viral. I'll do that. And it's like, if you're always chasing a respective trend, you're never at the forefront. You're never leading. And in some ways your work is derivative. So to avoid those qualms, it's to know who you are and create what is true to you.
Yeah. I was going to say, I don't think that you used a word a second ago that made it sound like you didn't want to use the word authentic, but I feel like we have to use the word authentic because there's so much of, especially social media, where people are putting on a persona and then everyone's trying to follow it. Like you feel bad about yourself because you can't follow it, but it's not real. And so I think
all of us are sad for no reason. Right? Like, you don't have to live like this.
And the people who rise tend to be the people like you who have a voice and it's a real voice. And, you know, you're using it for good, but it's also, there's an authenticity to it. So that's why it's, no one can copy it, right? Like,
thank you.
No one could do, I think, the show that you're doing. Like, there are other variety shows in the space, for obviously, but you can't copy each other or they can't live together in the space.
Totally. Thank you. Yeah, I think my proudest moment is when people watch my interviews from 2016 for the first time in 2021 and say, oh, this is so funny. Why am I so late to this? Like, this is so unique. And when people ask me like, oh, how did you come up with the idea last summer? It's like, well, I've been doing this for years. And that's where I feel the most proud of my work is that I've stayed consistent with this art when no one cared. And it's finally paid off.
Z-Way premieres Sunday, May 9 at 11 p.m. on Showtime. And that's it for this edition of Variety's Award Circuit Podcast. Drew Griffith edited this episode, and Michael Schneider is the producer. Be sure to subscribe to the Award Circuit Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. And also, head on over to Variety.com and click on the Award Circuit tab to find the latest Emmy predictions and key races, as well as your daily fix of news, analysis, and reviews. For Danielle Terciano and Jazz Tanke, I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you on the circuit.